Good Citizen Radio Bleeds. Train by day, Radio Bleeds by night. All day, all night, yeah.
Everybody wants information, but it comes so cheaply. Everybody wants a new reaction, but they're all still sleeping.
Welcome, good citizens, to the inaugural episode of Good Citizen Radio Bleeds, not a podcast. This is the first half of a two-part conversation with a friend, former academic advisor, and someone whom I privately refer to as my red pill guru, professor of sociology and cultural studies at Jagiellonian University in Krakow, Poland. He is the author of numerous academic articles and books on everything from globalization to cosmopolitanism to football hooliganism to our digital culture and how it's especially shaping younger generations. His most recent book is titled Virtually Lost: Young Americans in the Digital Technocracy. The second half of our conversation will appear on my X channel next week, a few days before it drops on Substack. So follow at Muy Macho Grande on X. There's a link below in the description. And that's enough babble for now. I give you, dearest good citizens, the first half of my conversation with Professor Gary Robeson. I'm joined by Professor Robeson on the inaugural episode of Good Citizen Radio Bleeds. Professor Robeson, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Congratulations on your book, Virtually Lost: Young Americans in the Digital Technocracy. I remember you emailing me last year when you had just finished this book, and you mentioned that it had taken a lot out of you. Can you describe what the process was of writing this book and what you mean by that? It took a lot out of you?
For some years, I must probably just say this, is in a way, it's kind of two books kind of smushed into one in a way that I hadn't anticipated before I wrote it. So I was going along in my kind of plodding way, doing the research into the things I've been interested in now for many years, like surveillance, plight of young people in the kind of technocratic smartphone mediated reality, the way in which they are manipulated, controlled, surveilled and instrumentalized, all those kinds of things. So I've been worrying away at this stuff about surveillance, the emerging kind of technocratic structure that was clearly being built around us piecemeal over the last 20, 25 years, and just kind of going along my own sweet way doing that with really very much a focus on young people and children and their experience of being so-called, it's a questionable term, I think, but so-called digital natives. So that was where I was going. And my general perspective was kind of pessimistic, but resigned. And I didn't think there was any hurry. We were in any particular hurry. And then when the COVID operation was rolled out, like so many of us, I
you had a sense of urgency.
A quickening.
Yeah.
A quickening of the program, a quickening of this. So I basically thought we had more time. And I kind of did assume that the establishment of a full spectrum, you know, surveillance and control based technocratic system was the goal. And we would arrive there eventually, since so few people seem to be waking up and everybody seemed to be addicted and immersed in their smartphones, which is obviously the facilitating technology for all of this. So I figured it was something that was going to roll out over time. And then when the COVID thing happened, it became apparent that there was a push underway to get a kind of a system of technocratic governance installed in the Western democracies much quicker. So, or by 2030, as we know.
So you're writing the book and
you're seeing
images of people in Paris, in other capitals around the world, in New Zealand, in Australia, people having to show vaccine passports just to participate in society. Did that make you give you a sense of urgency that, okay, I really need to
The fact that we were all... Yes, things like that, and the fact that we were all put under house arrest on the basis of what was clearly a globally coordinated, centrally administered program, gave me much more of a sense of urgency. And then I went through a process of trying to put these two things together, which wasn't very difficult. But what it did mean is once I'd been focused on things like the surveillance capitalism, all that Jing Twang stuff, the narcissism epidemic, the way that surveillance capitalism was impacting kids. I think in the Shoshana Zuboff book of that name, she has a very, very solid and important account of of the kind of catastrophe for the development of young people that instrumentarian surveillance capitalism has produced. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing all of that. But then once I began to think much more about technocracy in the early COVID days, reading, watching things on YouTube when things could still be said on YouTube, and just picking up getting together a more coherent picture of what technocracy was, what its background and history was, and what the prospects for it were now that the technology exists to make a dream of many hundreds of years realizable.
Right.
The dream of some actors of many hundreds of years. I felt it was necessary to develop for myself a much fuller understanding of what technocracy is.
If you don't mind, let's start with technocracy, because a lot of good citizens listening to this have heard the term. They have heard other people use the term, and they've read the term a lot, particularly in the past, in recent years. Just out of curiosity, last night I went on Google Trends and I looked up the word technocracy. And lo and behold, in March, April, May of 2020, when they locked down the whole global population, the search trend doubled.
Right.
So let's start with technocracy. Could you define technocracy for us and maybe take us through a sort of historical evolution of the term?
I can try. I was initially really schooled in this by Patrick Wood.
Right.
Who both had a very strong presence on YouTube in those early days, and whose books I quickly caught up with and read, and then took it from there. But I think technocracy is really an old idea. In fact, it's there in Plato. I think had an idea of a technocratic Greek society run by an elite of people who knew best.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes away for a long time. But then at the beginning of the scientific, close to the beginning of the scientific revolution, and then a bit later in the aftermath of the French Revolution, the idea comes around that science, or we might say scientism, the belief in science as a almost as a creed or a faith system, belief system, that the answer to humanity's problems was for people to be organized scientifically and systematically, not by monarchs, nor by politicians, nor by any of the usual suspects, but by experts working on the basis of scientific predictability in the management of societies. So you get perhaps the most important, really early pioneer of technocracy, Saint-Simon, the French philosopher of technology, who in the aftermath of the French Revolution is saying, well, look what we're learning from the natural sciences. Look how amazing science is. Because science is extraordinary because it predictable accounts of reality. You can predict, you can do your experiment and then you can predict outcomes. So he thought this kind of analytical predictability could be fed into social planning. They'd already kind of had a go at this during in the early phase of the French Revolution, if you look back at it, where they had a year zero program, didn't they? So they said, let's start again. We're going to start a new society now. We're going to remove all of the kind of royalist and Catholic religious trappings of the culture. We're going to decimalize everything. We're going to rationalize society from first principles, starting at the year zero with 10 months and 10 weeks and 10 days of the week and 10 months of the year and all the rest of it. That goes to hell very quickly, doesn't it, in kind of repression and mass murder.
Terror one and terror two.
Terror.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, and Saint-Simon is really seeing an even more chaotic and order requiring situation than before. So I think he gets the credit for being the person to really pull together an idea for a program, which is rational, so-called scientific planning and organization of human societies. And from that time on, other people would put it earlier. It's a Francis Bacon being the first person to realize that. But from that time on, the idea kind of grows that modern ways of thinking and methods of instrumental rationality could and should be applied to social organization in order to limit chaos, stabilize economies, and mitigate against things like the election cycle as we come into the democratic period, in which politicians come and go every so often, usually thinking in terms of their own interests, not being particularly, not having much in the way of expertise about anything, and that a good solution for this would be post-democratic or non-democratic government by experts, and I suppose the kind of higher level of so-called elite players who would manage and control the experts. So I think a basic definition of technocracy could just be that. Now, yeah.
But it is the absence of the state, and it is political in the sense that it is, if political science is the organizing of society or the principles of organizing a society, it is political in that sense. But in many ways, it's also psychological because it's a kind of social engineering program of permanent bureaucracy, of unelected permanent experts that can't be deposed.
Yeah, they can't be deposed, and they are experts. And then that takes you into another strain of thinking, which is all of the work on the managerial state that starts with James Burnham, you know, right, after the period after the war, in which the idea comes forward that permanent bureaucracies of technocratic managers would be the best system for keeping societies stable, rationally organized, and moving forward on that basis. So you've got the whole story of the managerial state, which is kind of flared up again more in recent years. Some of the kind of American paleoconservatives like Paul Gottfried, Sam Francis, those guys were writing about the writing about the managerial state in those terms, because the managerial state becomes a kind of therapeutic, technocratic system for managing populations in desired directions. So I think you've got technocratic managerialism brings two strands of thinking together. And then what makes it, gives it a lot of impetus in more recent years is the technology itself.
Right.
And we could in the book, I go for a long history of various aspects of technocratic thinking over a 300 or 400 year period.
Can you talk about technocracy from Taylorism through Technocracy Inc. from the early part of the century through the '30s? Because isn't that a big foundation of what came later, of what inspired David Rockefellers and the Trilaterals?
Yes, I think so. Because with the technocracy we're looking at now, two things are coming together, which is the technocratic kind of rationality and machinery, and it's the money power. Mm-hmm. So what you see in the early part of the 20th century, the Rockefeller and Carnegie, the robber barons.
The first Gilded Age, yeah.
Yeah, first Gilded Age, just put this kind of long-term struggle between monopoly and antitrust, between a new kind of actor of a kind of driven kind of man who has produced for himself unlimited wealth and therefore influence and ambition.
And therefore being above the state and above politicians and in
being
terms
above
of power.
Everything and more than that. And actually arrogating to themselves a desire to actually plan and shape society, you know, actively themselves. So I think the key to technocracy as we're now experiencing it, and going back 100 years to the period we're sort of talking about, is the coming together of the highest level of the money power on a monopoly basis. Mm-hmm. So then there's a kind of a merger of sort of perspectives. You've got that. You've got Taylor, who is introducing the concept of scientific management,
right,
which is to break factory work down into time, compartmentalized division of labor, all that division of labor stuff, into smaller and smaller units in the name of maximal efficiency,
right?
And the reducing of the human as to a kind of a facilitating cog in a bigger machine, which is, I think, is a very important longer term element in to technocracy,
as kind of shown.
You've got that going on
in Chapman's film Modern Times.
Yeah, brilliantly satirized. Show, yeah, and such yeah. a brilliant film. Yeah. Right. So you've got the system, glorification of the system, and the idea, as Jacques Ellul and many others would say later in the 20th century, of almost the inevitability of humans having to accept that they will be assimilated into machine systems,
right,
of one kind or another, or technological systems of one kind or another. So Taylorism, the interesting thing about Taylorism is Lenin, the Soviets loved Taylorism as well, because they were looking for their own version of a completely... Actually, this is an interesting point. It's kind of on topic. Recently, I've been looking a lot at how there's a kind of love-in starting to occur between the Chinese Communist Party and BlackRock and the ESG system, if you look at it.
Right, right.
And some people are starting to say now, perhaps this is something we have to circle back to make it clearer, but you look at the current iteration of the institutions kind of running the big American money power system, and they are starting to talk in a very communistic kind of way. I guess communism is a very good form of monopoly.
Right. There's no opposition.
All the resources.
Right.
There's no opposition. It gathers all the resources. And G.K. Chesterton said...
Any opposition is lined up against the wall.
Yeah, there's no opposition. You have all the power and you have all the resources and you're making all the decisions. And you build a technocratic economic and industrial system to ensure that there is some economic growth and all of that. So there seems to be, I think I'm starting to see some convergence now.
And well, you do write about this in your book a few times.
Yeah.
The kind of common thread throughout the theme of technocracy through its sort of chronological evolution is that all the proponents and adherents of technocracy who espoused its wonders in whatever form they did at whatever time they lived, beneath all of them is a utopian socialist or a Fabian socialist, or which molds perfectly with the Chinese Communist Party and BlackRock and the language that they use, and even the United Nations and the language that they use in their Agenda 2030, Agenda 21, which we can get to later. But
I think it's all either utopian socialism or, in the case of the United Nations and Agenda 21, pseudo-utopianism as a cover for something else. But yeah, that's there the whole time. The utopian impulse is there. Taylor is then succeeded by the Technocracy Inc. in the 1930s. They peaked the Technocracy Inc. movement, which was a very big thing at the time in the 1930s. It's been largely forgotten now, although not in the last 3 years. More and more people have, like myself, have come to understand more about it. So a group of a kind of cultic group in the 1930s, in the United States and in Canada, had a vision for wrote the kind of system plan for a fully technocratic society, which included things that were then impossible, but are now just about becoming possible, including the full-time surveillance of the consumption habits of all individuals.
Right.
And they, a fun fact, which some of your listeners may like to know, is that the head honcho of the Canadian branch of Technocracy Inc. was Elon Musk's grandfather, paternal grandfather, I think. So that particular technocrat hasn't fallen very far from the tree, I think. But that takes you to a Musk discussion, and that's we don't have time for now. No. So then there's the...
But Technocracy Inc. Evolved out of, it has connections to 40 years later, the Trilateral Commission, because it evolved out of Columbia University, no?
It was all in Columbia. Yeah. Columbia University, at one point, you had the Technocracy Inc. there sharing research space in their basement or their kind of basement areas there with IBM, early iteration of IBM.
Right.
IBM began to lease its tabulation machines to the Nazis to facilitate their... processing of the Holocaust.
Their train works.
The Edwin Black has a great book on that. IBM and the Holocaust. The proto computer tabulating machines, the punch cards, the tattoos on the forearm, all actually speaking to something very important, which is the utter ruthlessness of the big American money power drive to increase itself to the extent of working and supporting the Nazi use of the technology, just as, and this has become more common knowledge recently, that the Nazi eugenics playbook is largely taken up from the preceding Rockefeller and Carnegie research in the United States. So I think that eugenics, which is another layer to this, eugenics mm-hmm. and population control through the understand through controlling populations through eugenics is another important element in the technocracy story. It seems to originate on both sides of the Atlantic, kind of around the same time, perhaps in Britain first, comes mm-hmm. across the Atlantic in the early part, in early 1900s. Right. And then it's actually a very respectable topic for the American elites foundations to be talking about.
The oligarchs were funding the research.
Yes. The Rockefellers funded the very first research ever into molecular biology. I mean, they were so far ahead of their time. They just needed to understand how genes really worked. So that's where your science of molecular biology originates. It originates in Rockefeller, the hunger for knowledge.
Right.
Just as a bit later, the American system of social science comes out of the University of Chicago-based Rockefeller program for information gathering about society as it was changing. I think it was like an intelligence operation in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Social science itself. And so that's all in the picture. So Columbia, you've got early IBM, you've got Technocracy Inc., and then a bit later, or some decades later, in the 60s, you've got Brzezinski studying there. And he's publishes a book in 1970 called Between Two Ages, in which he, I think, is perhaps the first to give a clear account of the coming possibility of surveilling and controlling populations in so-called democratic countries through the new kinds of technology. Mm-hmm. And I think the story is that David Rockefeller reads his book, mm-hmm. thinks you can construe Brzezinski's book as a warning, or there's some sense of, if you want to be charitable, kind of foreboding in it. But I think Rockefeller mm-hmm. reads it as a lip smacking
tutorial.
It's like a tutorial and a pointer to the future.
Right.
And this is where you get the launched the Trilateral Commission, which is, along with a few of these other 1960s, 1970s type institutions like the Club of Rome.
Which was also David Rockefeller, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's sniffing around at the beginning, and a guy called Aurelio Pace, the multimillionaire Italian industrialist, who gave one of the a presentation at one of the first very early World Economic Forum meetings in 1972. So that's all there.
Hmm.
Now you've got the real big money interest is begun to understand that a technological framework and apparatus is not that far away, in which much more top-down management and control of populations and societies, it looks like it's going to become possible. And I think that's really what brings us very quickly to where we are now.
Okay, I think that's a pretty good, pretty substantial sort of chronological review of technocracy. It brings us to the Club mm-hmm. of Rome, the Trilateral Commission. I think here is where we see a transition from the 20s, 30s, and pre- and 19th century social Darwinism that morphed into eugenics, that kind of takes over the environmental movement, the Sierra Club, the Earth First movement, these sort of environmentalist movements that are growing out of the early 1970s. This global technocratic machine takes over these movements with the aim of population control. Because after World War II, the Nazis had given eugenics a bad name, and they had kind of had to repackage their agenda to make it more mm-hmm. palatable for the public. Yeah. And what's more palatable and consumable than, well, the Earth is melting and it's our fault, and we have to take a number of drastic measures to address this. So if you can take us now maybe through the sort of co-opting of the environmentalist movement, Agenda 21, Agenda 30.
I think it begins really with the Club of Rome mm-hmm. and the book they published, this research they did. It's not research, is it? It's all kind of very dodgy computer modeling.
Right.
That they did, and they produce a book called Limits to Growth. I'm forgetting the year now, but it's early 70s, I think. 72.
It's 71 or 72, yeah.
Yeah. And this billionaires club, and I think this whole thing really we can see as a billionaires revolt in a way, or mm-hmm. billionaires. There's a guy I've discovered recently on YouTube called Shahid Bolson. Have you come across him? He's very interesting.
No.
He's very militant Muslim who makes very, very sharp and clear-sighted geopolitical commentary. And he's very even-handed when he's not talking about religion, when he's talking about geopolitics. Yeah. And he calls this group the owners and controllers of financialized global capital. And he argues that we are now seeing a revolution or the coup being staged by this group. And I think we can – this group includes very much so the kind of Club of Rome, Rockefeller system, trilateral coalition, trilateral commission types. And they see – and I think you have to be given credit for the brilliance of their kind of foresight and Machiavellianness, if that's a word, of their long-range planning to use emotion – and fear, very much in the COVID propaganda mold, you start to focus on people's basic insecurity and fear triggers, like survival, reproduction, survival of the planet, survival of us, and all of that. And you start to manipulate people through their emotions increasingly expertly. Now they've got it down to a fine art, of course, but the idea back then, early 70s, I think, was to try and terrify people. And especially young people. And I think coming back to young people, since that time, we've seen young people really targeted psychologically in the most ruthless way by these actors. Because revolutions take time. And if you can pre-program future adults into true believers of something through continual repetition of manipulative, you know, practices while they're still young and being formed, then you've got that. Well, to me, one of the biggest problems we face now is that so many people have bought the climate emergency propaganda because they've had it dripped into their heads since they were 4 years old, through school, through the culture, through its complete normalization. So I think they saw that back then. They saw that this fear and emotion based of persuading people was going to be the way to go. And so they do that. They make these absurd, easily debunked computer models that saying, you know, we're all about to die. The Earth has this sort of short amount of time. There's this too many people in the world, which has also been comprehensively debunked ever since by people really going by the facts and using coherent arguments.
You reference a book by a group at Oxford University that debunked the limits of growth within a matter of years after it was published. Yeah. And I think they called it the limits to the limits of growth or something. I don't remember the title.
But they debunked this modeling. Yes, in real time, but almost straight after, 2 or 3 years after. Right. And this question of computer modeling, we see it crops up time and time again. We had it in the early weeks and months of the so-called pandemic, didn't we? With this Ferguson guy from Imperial College in London making comically inaccurate and unreliable computer modeling predictions, to get the ball rolling. So that's the thing. A lot of the climate stuff has been driven by these very, very sketchy or downright kind of nefarious computer so-called modeling. Again, an aspect of technocracy. People hear computer model, computer. You have the veneration of the computer and of kind of digital information. And it's hoped that people will buy that stuff. But the real thing about the Club of Rome intervention, and this is very well documented, and a lot of people, more and more people are writing about this and talking about it these days, is that in order to get humanity's attention, humanity at large, they needed an enemy. And they went through a long list of potential enemies and ended up deciding that the real enemy was humanity itself. And since that time, since the early 70s, successive generations of young people have had it dropped into their heads. The world is in peril because humans are bad. Humans are profligate, destructive plague upon the earth themselves, in a way. The humans are the virus.
Humans are the virus, right.
The humans are the virus, yeah. The humans are the virus. And so there's a very clear line between that early 70s proto-climate scare stuff and where we are now, not only with the climate, but also with the COVID operation, which are clearly merged.
To what extent do you think that these people have cried wolf too much? Because growing up in public school in the 80s, I remember being told that the ozone layer, you know, was on its last days, and Well, especially over the Amazon forest, and the Amazon forest was going to be gone. And if the Amazon forest goes, the entire earth goes. This was in public school. Well, which should be no surprise to anyone who attended public school in the United States, which is, you know, a center for indoctrination. But looking back on it now, I see how manipulative and how borderline demonic it was that they were instilling this unfounded fears in students that the earth was on its last days. And if we didn't change our behavior, we didn't change our actions. Yeah. And we weren't sort of conscious about this and that, that we were a part of the problem and we were the ones responsible. But in your mind, how often have they cried wolf? Because that was late Gen X, and now we've had millennials gone through, and now we're on Zoomers. And everything that they told millennials in the 90s and the aughts in public school, you know, these glaciers aren't going to be existing by the year, 2020. They've had to take down those signs, by the way, in Glacier National Park in northern Montana. Yeah. Because every catastrophizing they've done over the last 30 years, 40 years, hasn't come to pass.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of ways of thinking about that. One is, the first thing that comes to mind is in regards explicitly to what you just said, is the knowledge gap, which is that you know and I know how they've cooked the data, taken the false stuff down, but young people don't. And I think one of the things that you soon learn when you're in a university teaching is, and this is not to attack the Zoomers, because I've got I've got three kids myself, and one of them's a Zoomer, which is good because I've got a kind of live research telephone dependent, telephone adjacent young human in the house still now.
Yeah.
But to see that it's extraordinary how little they know in terms of what we used to call general knowledge. And it's very common now to encounter people in their 20s who have very, very little of what we used to call unproblematically general knowledge. It's not there. It's in the devices. It's been externalized, kind of outsourced out to the devices.
Right.
And that's the way it seems to be now. But what it means is that history and reality can be written in real time now because they've got their faces in these phones all of the time, increasingly having their kind of responses and understandings automated. We're in a very strange moment, I think. I'll give you a concrete example of what it is I'm trying to say. About a month or two ago, when we had all of this craziness in with the fires, the world was on fire. The world was on fire, according to the guy at the UN.
You were in Cyprus at one of those fires, weren't you?
I was in Corfu.
Oh, Corfu.
I was on Corfu in holiday with a very serious looking hill fires coming down the hill overnight while I slept on the balcony to be like an early alarm system, because I suffer from asthma. And if I get around smoke, I get it. I'm a coal mine canary. There was a huge fire right by where we were staying. And point is
BBC, right?
It was also the mayor of North Corfu said that counted 643 separate fires started.
Arson.
For a variety of reasons. Yeah, all arson, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So I was sitting in my kind of hotel room watching this happen, watching the local people very calmly, very stoically, very bravely, just fighting the fires without any panic. The most anxious-looking group of people I've ever seen, but in good order and just dealing with the problem. And then I went into the hotel room and switched off on Sky News, and it was showing you the ring of fire around the Mediterranean. You know, the world is boiling.
The world is burning.
Your world is burning and boiling. And it was a very interesting juxtaposition. But the point I'm trying to get to is that around that time in the summer, the BBC and other entities have switched the scales, the color scale, not only the colors of the maps, the weather maps, so that everything that was once green or orange is now burning red. The orange part of the scale starts at 20 degrees. So now, how is a 15-year-old who doesn't know very much, doesn't know about really any kind of history to speak of, let alone history of the climate and the various shenanigans that have happened around that, how are they supposed to know any better? So I think there's one thing. I think there's a shift in kind of what people know. It opens up a lot of potential for rewriting of history not only history, of contemporary reality as well. That takes us to maybe things like woke politics and all of that. A lot of people do seem to be waking up or kind of smelling a rat with all of this climate hysteria. And it's hard to judge, you know, what the proportions of people are, isn't it? But I still do think that this information, this story, this narrative is so pervasive, kind of fixed and ruthlessly applied, especially where children are young people are concerned.
Perhaps that's a good transition because, well, every tyrant, every dictator in history has gone after the youth and or tried to weaponize the youth, partly mm-hmm. out of their idealism, partly out of their activism, partly out of the desire to change and to seek change. And clearly, yeah. they're going after young people in the same way Mao did during his Cultural Revolution.
Yes.
With his little red guard. Exactly. And you're seeing that now play out on university campuses. And that's sort of the breeding ground of their weaponization of the youth. I don't know if you want to transition into what's happening on university campuses or maybe first start at how technology is affecting young people, their attention spans, their education, because you write about social emotional learning and the classroom laboratory, because they're getting mm-hmm. the children before they get to university.
Yeah, they're getting the children very young now, yeah. as young as they can get them.
Right.
So this is the thing I'm interested in most at the moment, because what I think I'm seeing, what I argue is that we're seeing a very concerted attempt now from the kind of actors that we are talking about, who, let's remember, they, you know, six corporations own 90% of American legacy and mainstream media. Then you've got the monopolies of the Silicon Valley type monopolies. So the messaging is relatively more easy to control now, the mainstream messaging than it's ever been. There's this. To go back to Shoshana Zuboff's book, The Age of mm-hmm. Surveillance Capitalism, although there are a number of very important insights in that book, the one that really got me was where she reveals how when Facebook got started, the early social media thing got started, they lock, stock and barrel kind of took on board as an operating system the technology and the strategies used by the old Las Vegas one-arm gambling machine technology, those slot machines.
Right. Yeah, slot machines, right.
And and she makes this point, which I've been thinking a lot about, because it opens up a whole new area of research in a way, that technology was based on lulling the user of the machine into what they call the zone, wasn't it? If you remember that stuff, the zone. Right. Now, the zone is you are completely immersed. Your kind of rational awareness is subdued. You get into a feeling of a pleasured, immersive mindlessness. Mm. And you just keep pumping money or tokens into the machine.
You just keep massaging those neurotransmitters of dopamine that get released on a continual basis, and it gets re-released and re-released. Yeah,
exactly. And then I think the idea with that's come around since this was normalized by Facebook is that when you're in that condition, you're all dopamined out. Your brain's not really working. Your monkey mind has kind of been switched off. You're in a good place. You are very open and suggestible.
Right.
Very open and suggestible to emotional messaging, especially emotional messaging that hits your gut, kind of bypasses your kind of rational defenses or reflexive kind of capabilities, and just start to hit you in the gut.
Right.
Pieces of music, images, key words or phrases, nothing very complex, just triggers. So when I look now at kids with a smartphone, what I see, a teenager in a smartphone, I see a kind of a cybernetic loop between the kid and the phone.
Hmm.
Cybernetic loops being about closed systems in which all the parts are kind of automated, mm-hmm. or can be kind of controlled. Wide open in that fuzzy kind of zone-like state, having images, propositions, fragments of music, and the way it all comes together on TikTok, that famous Chinese unrestricted warfare, cognitive warfare platform. I mean, the Chinese know what they're doing with unrestricted warfare. They know they've been doing that because they know it works.
Right.
And it works by, I think, getting kids into this kind of very suggestive, trance-like, suggestible state, and then providing some input into that kind of space. Now, Shoshana Zuboff writes about how the Silicon Valley culture is to automate users' experience at the screen interface. You know, so that there's you, there's your screen. You're in the right kind of, you're in the headspace they want you in. And then this is where I think it's connecting to, for example, the Maoism and the super woke indoctrination of kids.
their desire is to assimilate. Their desire is to belong at that age and to feel like a part of something, right?
Yeah, two things. One is that, which means that the things that we all used to, people of our age, Mr. Citizen, used to do in our bodies, which is negotiate with other young people, you know, in the real world, in the actual world, you know, figure out how to become a social person through trial and error, through interacting with others. This is now largely done online. So there's that whole thing about kids need to belong, to establish relationships, to figure out who they are and where they fit, to develop a coherent social self. That's all there and very easily exploited, and very easily exploited along another channel, I think, which is to do with their natural tendency just for things to be fair, for people to be nice to one another, for there to be, you know, good guys and bad guys, and the bad guys get punished. Which is why so much of the, for example, you look at Agenda 21 or 30, it's all written like it's as if it was all written for 6-year-olds. It's very different. You don't see substance. You see fuzzy, nice fuzzy words that no 8-year-old, you know, wouldn't understand. 8 or 10-year-old,
right?
So I think that's all there, and I think that the push, which is top down and connected to the ESG system and the woke religion or kind of metaphysical system, I see it as a theological justification for the technocracy, really. You could argue, and I'm trying to understand it better, being kind of plumbed into kids beneath the level of their explicit awareness while they're still quite young and vulnerable and open, very much like the Chinese, the Red Guard during the Cultural Revolution. So it's based on irrationality and emotion. So I reckon that you can clearly see now the smartphone or the screen in general being pressed into the service of a kind of very powerful form of indoctrination.
It's interesting because in your book you mention Heidegger and Heidegger's seminal work, The Question Concerning Technology.
Yep.
And you bring up two terms that you selected in relevance to what you've just been talking about for the last few minutes in terms of our relationship to technology. And two of Heidegger's terms are standing reserve and Dasein. Is it Dasein or Dasein?
Dasein,
Okay. Can you explain those two terms and how they relate to what we're seeing today with kids and their smartphones?
I can, although I am not going to pretend to be a Heidegger expert.
No, that's okay. Nobody's a Heidegger expert.
No, I think there are a small number of people who think they are. They live in a very special world of their own.
Yeah, there's three people.
Because what I try to do so once I came across two things, the two really things that kind of almost occurred simultaneously, which is Jacques Ellul's work on the technological society, which is he's working on in the early 1950s.
Right.
And then you've got Heidegger giving a series of lectures in the late 40s, which end up being collected in this book, Question Concerning Technology, seem to be really very important for understanding everything that's happened since that time and contextualizing a lot of the other things we've already mentioned.
Right.
So I did what I could with Heidegger without claiming any kind of expertise. I'm not trained in philosophy either.
But those are two relevant terms, I think, standing reserve.
But they're relevant, and I think there are extremely relevant things coming from there. And my understanding of Heidegger, my kind of understanding of Heidegger is that what he's really interested in is what happened to being. Mm. And this is where the design comes into, to being as a kind of phenomenological mystery of existence itself. Now, I can't answer that question, but what I do know, and which seems clear, and so far as anything in Heidegger is clear, that when he writes about technology, he's not writing about, he's talking about techne, not talking about machines in any given form. He's talking about a process, a long-term civilizational process in which all of the being in the world is gradually brought under control, brought into control and turned into things. And this includes beings. It struck me that this is a perfect statement in a way. The manipulation of children and young people in the way we've already mentioned, like the dopamine, the kind of encouragement of dopamine addiction, the manipulation of their emotions, the stealing of all of their sort of intellectual of their attention and their their interactions, the instrumentalization of them as raw material for exploitation. What you see, I think, is the treatment of those particular humans as things, They, this instrumentalized approach to the manipulation of everybody in this system, but kids especially, is a process of turning them into treating them like they are things, like Charlie Chaplin in the in Modern Times, in Cog in the Machine, like things.
Right. So, and those things are
these things
standing reserve.
All everything that there is in the world, including all of the beings that there in the world, that there are in the world, over time become reduced to things waiting to be marshaled, organized, exploited,
and marshaled into the technological systems.
Yes. Yes, yeah. And that's where I think Elul has much more to say, really. But if you put the two together, you've got Heidegger saying that technology, not machines, but the broader process that we call technology, which is an ongoing and ever-expanding way of humans imposing themselves on the world and managing it for their own, or some of them managing it for their own ends, is something that eclipses and reduces being into a thing-like state. And then you've got Elul, more or less the same time, making the very early, I think, and brilliantly foresighted prediction in the Technological Society, published in 54, and a British edition in English language edition in 64.
You refer to Elul here. Jacques Ellul's contention that the technological society would end up producing a situation in which humans would have, out of necessity, to assimilate themselves to an all-encompassing, increasingly autonomous technological system, rather than systems being tools for human use. So we are forced to assimilate to technological progress, technological solutionism, technological determinism, rather than those systems or tools being merely tools for our use and for our benefit.
So this is the classic kind of question. And I meet people all the time who say, stop, why do you bitch and moan about smartphones all the time? It's just a tool.
You Luddite.
And I say, okay, come and spend it. Yeah, some tool. And you look at a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old or whatever, especially a girl, actually. I think a lot of the boys have just checked out and they're playing games. But on social media, at the beginning of the book, I just mentioned some of the fact that in a very short period, fairly recently, the suicide rate amongst American teens doubled, but it doubled more dramatically among girls than among boys.
And you can distinctly see this rise after the first smartphone is issued in 2008, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's almost...
It starts there.
It depends on whether you believe in coincidences or not. Doesn't. It looks like too much of a coincidence to me, because there's so much at stake for, let's say, I've got my daughter. The daughter is in the other room with me here now, is 14 years of age, and it's so important for her to have this phone. She's doing so many kind of social and psychological things on it, making them happen on it that are necessary for her and her friends. To suggest that phone is just a tool of hers, I'm pretty sure it's the other way around. I think we become tools of the... Well, Thoreau said it, didn't he? Thoreau said, the way things are going, men will become the tools of their tools.
Right.
So I think that's where we are, in an accelerated kind of way. Not enough people seem to be realizing this or trying to resist it. And I think we are, as Elul predicted... The process whereby we are becoming assimilated of necessity into a machine as machine-like elements is accelerating, and it's done on the basis of us being treated as things, period, by said system.